The rise of Donald Trump as the Republican candidate for president has many Americans, politicians, journalists, and ordinary citizens alike racing to play catch-up to better understand not only his appeal, but the hearts and minds of those who support him. Sociologist and best-selling author Arlie Hochschild has been doing this quite a while, a bit ahead of the curve. For the past decade, from her home in Berkeley, California, she became increasingly curious about red America. She wondered, why do people in poor red states who would seem to benefit most from liberal government intervention abhor the very idea? Why do so many on the political right vote against what seems to be their self-interest? How do those on the right understand their self-interest, and how does Trump appeal to it? To do this, she embedded herself in Lake Charles, Louisiana, about as red a place as you can find. She attended fish fries and cook-offs and Pentecostal church services, as well as Trump rallies, and had long conversations over card games, cookies, and just discussions with people whose political beliefs differed greatly from her own. The result is the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Arlie Hochschild is one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. She's the author of 9 books, including The Second Shift, The Time Bind, and The Managed Heart. Again, the name of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Arlie Hochschild to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
My pleasure.
What brought you to this particular subject of having a curiosity about red America and wanting to find out more?
Well, you know, I began this journey in 2011. It's been 5 years that I've been trying to talk to people and understand their perspective. And I think what brought it to me was already then there was a sense of split, that we live in a different enclaves, both geographic and, you know, a television enclaves and internet enclaves, and we're in this schizophrenic state of being exposed to a lot of public hostility. You could already sense it 5 years ago, but it's really extreme now. And at the same time, you didn't know anybody personally to sit down over coffee and talk over differences as deep as there are in our country today. So I wanted to get out of my enclave and go to one as far right as mine was left. I live in Berkeley, California, and I thought, okay, let me just go to the opposite place on the earth and sit down and get to know people. And they were great. They really opened their doors and went to fish fries and gumbo cook-offs and followed a Tea Party candidate around, went to meetings of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, and really got a different way of thinking, a different truth, a different way of feeling. And so the book is about that.
As I mentioned, you wound up in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and in a way it's the perfect place for you to conduct this experiment, right?
Right. Right. Because kind of what I, just looking at the books, I thought, well, where in America have things gone more right? Well, that's among whites. And in what region? That's the South. And where in the South? When I looked at the 2012 proportion of whites working for voting for the reelection of Barack Obama, it was 46% of white Californians voted for him, 29% of whites in the whole South, and only 14% Louisiana. So I thought, okay, Louisiana's the super South. Let me go there.
When you sit down and you talk individually, do the differences become apparent right away?
They do. They do. I guess the first thing that Well, let me just give you an example. I was sitting at a meeting of this Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana. Across the window of the table was a very lively woman, the wife of a Pentecostal minister herself, a very gifted a gospel singer, and she said, I love Rush Limbaugh. So I thought I should talk to her and get to understand that. So later we had sweet teas together and at a coffee shop, and she immediately said, well, the thing I like about this radio commentator, right wing, Rush Limbaugh, is that he really has it in for environmental wackos and feminazis. So she liked these. So I immediately knew I was really in a different world here. But you know what happened with that? As I'm listening to her, I'm trying to take my own alarm system off. I'm not there to convince her of anything. I'm there to understand, kind of, and see if I can empathize with where she's coming from. And that's the whole experiment here. And she looked at my face, and she said, do you agree with what I said? Well, actually, no, but it doesn't matter. And she was defining feminists very hard-nosed and, you know, everyone out for themselves. Actually, I had thought that was the right-wing Ayn Rand's picture of social life, you know. Mm. So really different images. But after a while, she said, you know, is it hard to listen? I said, not at all. She said, well, I can do that too. I do that sometimes. I listen to people I don't agree with. And then she said, you know what I really love about Rush Limbaugh is that he defends people like me against liberals, because liberals are insulting us. Liberals are saying, oh, you stupid Southern Bible-thumping people, ignorant. And he's standing up for me. Well, I learned something in 5 minutes that I'd never learned before, you know? And a lot of people felt very insulted by liberals, and that their region was put down, that their religion was put down, that their social attitudes was put down, their social class was put down. And so it didn't take long for me to discover a very different truth. But it wasn't just the individuals, the whole place almost had a politics. You know, and the Democrats are very much in minority there. One woman said, oh, in my, you know, water aerobics class, I'm the only Democrat. And she sort of could whisper to someone else that she thought was. So the whole place really reflected a kind of, it was as much an enclave as where I came from.
Arlie Hochschild is our guest. The name of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. You have already been talking a lot about empathy and empathizing with those that you talk to. You write in the book about the empathy wall. What are empathy walls?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. You can't see them, but you can feel them. And, you know, if you get on the internet and you look at some people's comments on articles, they're very harsh. Liberals can be very harsh toward conservatives and vice versa. And so we're just kind of creating little balls of facts and shaping them into darts, and kind of each one is a board to the other. An empathy wall is where you actually purposely let down your guard to try and walk in the shoes of the other person. And I came to feel that underneath politics, and this is a major part of Strangers in Their Own Land, lies a deep story, a kind of metaphorically driven kind of story that feels true. And I think Democrats have a deep story and Republicans have a deep story, and that when you cross an empathy wall, you can really get to sit down and hear the deep story of the other.
The subtitle of the book is Anger and Mourning on the American Right. How soon, you talk about that idea of empathy, but how soon into this do you feel that anger?
Yeah, Well, when people were very friendly, the door was not closed. You know, some people said to me, well, thanks for coming. You know, people don't know about us. And we don't feel understood. We're the Passover state. And so that didn't feel hard at all. And they wanted to tell me how that was hurtful. So actually, if you make the first step, they make the first step back. I guess that's really one major lesson here and why it actually turned out to be an enjoyable experience, even though the differences are enormously. People ask me, oh, did this change your politics 5 years, really immersing yourself in the lives of right-wingers? Actually, no, it didn't, but it changed me as a human being. It gave me more respect and empathy for some really amazing people and an understanding of the context that leads them to lean, in this case, for Trump.
How much, we'll get to that in a second, how much, though, did you want to defend yourself in this? So let's go back to the Rush Limbaugh discussion for a moment. And you said you learned a lesson. You learned a lesson that people liked Rush Limbaugh because he stood up for them and stood up for the liberals who put down the South and put down much of what they believed in. Were you able to say at some point, you know, when we listen to him, liberals, we feel as though we are being put down?
That's right. Yeah. You know, that came much later. I felt that the purpose of my being there was to understand her and to empathize with her, and that it was not a dangerous thing for me to do. In fact, maybe I could pick up some lessons for liberals. Maybe we're really missing out. As one person said, hey, this is a whole constituency liberals should be speaking to, and yet we're insulting these people. What's going on? And so my purpose was not to say, here's how I hear Rush Limbaugh, although those were two insults that did fit me. Although later she got curious. She got curious, and we had a conversation. But I didn't feel impelled to. That wasn't my purpose.
Arlie Hochschild is considered one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. The name of her new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning and the American Right. We will continue our conversation with Arlie Hochschild after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our guest this morning is Arlie Hochschild, author of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Arlie Hochschild is a sociologist and best-selling author and decided to leave Berkeley, California, go to Lake Charles, Louisiana, and find out more about why there is such a political divide. Again, the name of the new book is Strangers in Their Own Land. You mentioned Donald Trump. You write a scene in the book about driving to a pro-Trump rally with a Trump supporter, and you say that it had, quote, been set for Trump's rise like kindling before a match is lit.
That's a very important crux of the book. It's the kindling is this, that here is a group of people who feel frightened and sad and on top of that angry, but I think basically a little bit in mourning for a number of reasons that all come together. It isn't any one thing. It's a constellation of reasons they feel marginalized. They feel culturally marginalized, as this very Pentecostal minister's wife said. Oh, you know, liberals think that I'm sexist and homophobic and, backward and fat. She said even she felt that liberals had, you know, different dietary habits and looked down on people that were stout. So she felt culturally put down, and she that there's a new law of the land, and she was backward. She felt as a religious person, well, if the world is more secular than it was, and that the honor associated with religion was challenged regionally, she felt, in a poorer region. Indeed, red states are much poorer. And her social class was also being ridiculed. Look at all the, get online, Google, and Google insults for rednecks, and it'll give you a picture. I mean, people are shown with bad teeth. Well, bad teeth is a sign of poverty, you know. There's another way to see these images. So anyway, we put it all together, they felt, she felt displaced, a stranger, estranged, a stranger in her own land. And she saw the government, democratic government, liberal government, as an instrument of that marginalization. Now, you and I would say, wow, gosh, how does she come to see it that way? I mean, isn't it also an instrument of help? But she didn't see it that way. And she felt that the government was displacing church and community and putting it all together. She was looking for a way out. She didn't feel that the government was representing her. And so Trump comes along as the right-wing outsider, and it has appeal. A lot of people that I talked to didn't go for him at first and were turned off by all the insults he hurls, but they so hated the alternative that they've been drawn to him, even the extremely religious people.
And the fact that he does not portray himself as a deeply religious man, or that there are these things that seem to be the opposite of the teachings of the Bible, that does not enter into this equation?
Well, that's a great question. Here's a man that's been married 3 times. He boasts in one of his books about the bestseller his book would be if he would describe the affairs he's had. He seems to be bragging about it. He says he's never asked God for forgiveness. And on it goes. I think that his appeal to religious believers is through by representing a secular version of the rapture. The rapture is a belief held by many millions of Americans that a judgment day will come in your lifetime, and a moment will come when the true believers will go up to heaven, and the rest will be left behind in what becomes a hell, and you are, you know, raptured up. But there is a moment of judgment in that you go up and you go down. I think Donald Trump has intuitively stumbled into that religious iconography, you could say. So he sets himself up as judge. You know, you're hired, you're fired. You know, you're a 10 on the beauty scale, you're a 1. And that there's an up and down. And that he's going to rescue people and make them all rich. And if you look at images of heaven in the rapture, they're, you know, golden images of heaven. If you look at Donald Trump's living room, everything's golden. I mean, right. It's even strange. So it's just a suggestion. I don't think this is, you know, the only thing going on, but I think people feel that he is godlike and a rescuer, unconsciously.
There also have been the many concerns in the liberal and progressive movements that the similarities between Donald Trump and Hitler. And mm-hmm. there are because of what he has said about entire groups and blocks of people. There was a former anchor for CNN on This Week in Soledad O'Brien talking about how in our quest, the media, to show this side versus that side, we have allowed people to come on to talk about Donald Trump, who, as she says, in a fairly direct quote, that we have normalized white supremacy in some ways. So with that said, does that concern the people that you talk to, that there is, even if they don't believe that that's the case, that that's how they are being portrayed?
Yeah, they don't like it at all. They feel very wary of being described as racist, and that's very much on their mind. So they disassociate themselves from that. But they feel between a rock and a hard place on that very issue. And that's something I focus on in the book, that they feel like the 60s was kind of a parade of people that culture was asked to feel sorry for. And those would be women who had been barred from men's jobs, blacks who had been barred from whites' jobs, immigrants that were very hard working but couldn't find a place. Now, adding to that, desperate refugees. And they feel like they have been pushed back and back and back in line, and that especially white men have felt that they are seen as highly privileged, but not, they don't feel highly privileged, that this way in which the privilege of whiteness didn't trickle down and the privilege of maleness didn't trickle down, and that they're really at the margin of privilege. And what they really feel, I think, is that what global capitalism has done to blacks, which is it's automated industrial jobs, it's offshored them, it's imported cheap labor, it's put them out of good jobs, is about to happen to them. And that they haven't had a raise in 20 years, and they're feeling worried about it, that they'll be next. And so that becomes their main story. That's what trumps every other story, even the story of are you, you know, following some grand wizard and being a super racist. There are super racists, but I guess what I'm saying is when you've got nearly half the American population, at least 40%, planning to vote for this person, you've got a very mixed bag there, and we can't say, oh, they're all, you know, alt-right.
Right.
A lot of them are very complex people with, you know, complex ambivalences, and without altering our own beliefs and commitments, I think the shoe is on the liberal foot to reach out and understand what's going on, so that we can, you know, speak to this sense of displacement.
Arlie Hochschild is our guest. The name of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. So let's focus on that just a moment. We'll put Donald Trump aside and just focus on that. So for you as a sociologist, you are able to go across the country, go to Louisiana, and sit down and talk to people in an environment that you have described as welcoming. So what prevents us as a culture, as a society, to not just do this in Louisiana, but for all of us, both liberal and conservative, to reach across and to have the very conversations that you had in some way to try to cross this bitter divide that we have created?
Nothing. And we all should do it. Actually, you know, next Thanksgiving a member of the Tea Party, a single mom with two children, is coming to our house to stay with us. And her son is for Bernie Sanders. So she's Tea Party. So within her own home, the national political division has come to the breakfast table. You know, she's trying to, in a wonderful way, hash it out issue by issue with her own son. And so they're coming here, and with Joan Blades, the co-founder of MoveOn.org and Moms Rising. She's a liberal. But she has started something called Living Room Conversations, where members of each side of this political divide get together respectfully and commit to attentive listening and see if they can find some crossover issues. And I do think they're there. In previous conversations that she's held, members of the Tea Party agreed with liberals that we ought to try and reduce prison populations, that that wasn't doing any good to anybody. So that's one crossover issue. I think the environment could be another. Even money in politics. I had a Tea Party guy say, let's get money out of politics. I said, boy, you have a big crossover issue right there. I couldn't agree more.
Do you have a sense that this particular election cycle, as ugly as it has been, is more damaging or ultimately, because you were in the thick of this during the primary writing this, or a sense that it is that now is as good a time as any to have these crossover conversations?
I think it's almost pushing us to, it is damaging. I think we have to undo a lot of damage. There have been a lot of insults back and forth, and we just don't live in the same reality. I'm keenly aware of that. So I think we have to, get informal communication channels going and then ask our politicians to get them going, too. But as you say, no time like the present. You have to wonder, you know, before Hitler came to power, there was a very high unemployment, very high social distress, people looking for answers, feeling estranged and desperate. How much did people, you know, people like who were frightened of Hitler and wanted an alternative, how active were they in trying to do something? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think that's the question we need to ask ourselves today.
Indeed. Did the experience alter your political thought or leanings at all?
No, not at all. I think it made me aware of new realities that I am not familiar with. For example, a lot of people spoke of being very irked by welfare cheats. And at first I was a little skeptical. Well, okay, what would be an example? And they gave me very specific examples, and it sounded plausible. I thought, well, maybe I don't know about that, you know, in my life. I don't come, it's not part of my experience. So I would say that probably it goes on, and that, you know, alternatives have to be found. I don't have the same resentment about it that the people I talk to do. That was really like almost a class warfare that they located there, whereas the class warfare that I tend to focus on is between the 1% and the 99%. You know, my focus differently. So I learned, you know, information, I guess, but it didn't alter my basic beliefs.
Were you ever scared?
Once, yeah, I would say. Someone I was talking to didn't seem that balanced, very rigid and very angry. But it was someone, not that I'd made an appointment to interview with, it was someone I had met casually. Yeah. And I would say at the Trump rally in New Orleans, when he pointed his finger, get those Black Lives Matter people out, come on, don't be so slow. I've had a moment of fear, you know, if that's the first thing he's doing is finding the enemy and expelling them. I found that frightening.
Well, the book is fascinating and optimistic, too. I would assume you feel this is an optimistic book.
Yes, I do. I do. They're good people on the other side. They're very searching, and they're as worried about this split as I was.
The name of the book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. The book is published by the New Press. Arlie Hochschild, I thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Again, the name of the book is Strangers in Their Own Land. It is published by the New Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.